And you're listening to WHTC in Holland. It's time now for Talk of the Town, the program in which you, the listeners, participate with your telephone calls. Our guest this morning is Nathan Box, attorney, and if you have questions for him, give us a call. Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning, Juke.
Well, what's new this morning?
There's, you know, I have been working very diligently on our website over at Central Park Law and the ability to give clients options to do some things online. And one of the things that I have been investigating and working on and trying to come up with solutions for people for is when you're dealing with your estate planning and your assets, that many of us now have a whole lot of what we refer to as digital assets and digital life. You know, if you've got an iTunes account where you've got movies and you've got videos, you need a way to be able to have people access that and preserve that if you were to pass away. People have Facebook accounts. People have Twitter accounts. People have Amazon.com accounts. People have email accounts. All of these assets, all of these things that they have accumulated that are very valuable to them, and in some cases have actual, you know, real, what we would consider real life dollar value. Some of the research that I've been doing on it says, you know, the average person may have anywhere from $6,000 to $20,000 worth of online digital assets that are all associated with different websites and different internet services that are behind usernames and passwords. And oftentimes the people that you leave behind don't know your username, don't know your password,
right,
and have not, and people haven't done what they need to do to be able to allow someone else to access that information. We're always told when we put those, you know, when we set those accounts up, to make sure that you keep that information safe and that you do your best to try to protect that. And that's actually the first thing that I wanted to talk about with folks is making sure that they're being careful with the usernames that they're using and the passwords that they're using, so that they're not easy to guess. Because if not only do you want to protect those assets for other folks after you pass away, you want to make sure that somebody can't steal them or take them away from you while you're alive and while you're here. And far too many people use the same username and use the same password for all kinds of different accounts.
Right.
And it's become very easy. And there's been some pretty celebrated situations where well-known people's accounts have been hacked, and they've taken over their Twitter feed, they've taken over their Facebook account, they've stolen digital assets from them, they've locked them out of their own email, simply because the people used the same password for a lot of different services. Looks like we've got a call coming in.
We got a call coming in. Good morning. You're online with the attorney.
Good morning.
Morning.
Does a restatement supersede a trust, or is it just an addition to the trust? I'll hang up and listen.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a little bit of a loaded question because it may mean one thing, it may mean another, but generally a restatement is oftentimes a complete replacement of the previous document. Rather than just an amendment or an addendum to the trust, we'll oftentimes do, and I generally do, a restatement, which is redoing the entire document. In this day and age with word processors, it's much easier for us as attorneys and for the people who are putting the documents together to go, you know what, rather than having the old document and then this amendment that goes with it and another amendment that goes with it and another amendment that goes with it, let's just consolidate everything into one clean document that encompasses everything. In most cases, the best way to be able to tell if that restatement is actually a replacement of the previous document is, usually in the first couple of paragraphs, it will say whether it completely supersedes any of the previous documents. When I put documents together, if it's a restatement, I'll say this one completely replaces the previous document and any previous documents are null and void. So it gets rid of all of those previous documents that are out there. But that's the easiest way to tell. If the caller's listening and looking at their document and not sure, I'm more than happy to take a look at that form and give them an idea of whether it is a replacement or just an addendum to the previous trust document.
Okay.
But lawyers are getting better at that kind of thing and making that language easier to understand so that clients can actually understand what it is that their documents say. So hopefully they'll be able to tell on their own. But if not, we can help them with that.
Okay.
We can do that.
395-1450, if you'd like to talk to the attorney this morning, we'd be happy to take your calls. 395-1450.
Yep. Now, what you want to do with those passwords?
Yes.
If you've got multiple accounts, and Juke, I'm sure you've got an iTunes account, and you've got a Facebook account, and you've got a Twitter account, you want to make sure, one, that you're using different usernames, different logon names for those different accounts, and that you're using different passwords for each one of those accounts. Mm-hmm. You do not want to have those all be the same. Looks like we've got another call.
Another call. Good morning. You're online with the attorney.
Well, good morning, Duke. Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if a person signs a document that is required to be recorded, if they sign that document as, let's say, either an individual with power of attorney signing for another, or as the representative of a trust, is that required to be underneath the signature on that document?
We definitely like it to be. We like to know what in what capacity you're signing that document, and especially if that document is notarized. The notary designation, the language that goes along with the notary, should specify in what capacity you are signing that, whether you are signing that individually, whether you are signing that as an agent under the power of attorney or a trustee of that trust, because you could sign in multiple different capacities. And if you're signing a deed, for instance, for someone else based on a power of attorney, and you just sign it with your own name and do not designate that you are the agent under that power of attorney,
yeah,
that deed may not mean anything at all. You know, I could sign a deed to you, a quitclaim deed for any piece of property in town that you would like, and sign my own name to it. What are you getting? Nothing, because I don't necessarily own that piece of property.
What about a circumstance where property is deeded to the wife according to the tax rolls and the husband signs the document?
Not necessarily effective, and there are two pieces to that. One is you want to be very careful about using the tax rolls as the determining factor as to who owns the property, because the tax rolls may show one name and the Register of Deeds office may show a different name, and it's what is recorded at the Register of Deeds office at the county that is the deciding factor in terms of who owns a piece of property. The tax rolls may or may not be accurate in terms of who the owner is.
Okay. Now, you said you would like it to be that way. Does that mean that it is required?
It is best practice to do that. You are asking for trouble if you do not designate that. But, you know, lawyers don't ever like to say never. And, for instance, if you signed a deed, assuming you were signing it under that power of attorney, you actually had power of attorney, you had the authority to sign that deed for that person, but you simply neglected to have, you know, agent under power of attorney in the signature, and we wanted to argue later in court that was actually a valid transfer, we could probably be successful in that argument. Now, do you want to have to go to court to prove that? Certainly you do not want to have to go to court to argue that. So it's best practice to make sure that you are signing, that the document designates in what capacity you are signing it. Otherwise, you're asking for trouble. Is it trouble we might be able to solve? Yes, but we'd rather not get in that trouble in the first place.
Sure, sure. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. We're here with attorney Nathan Box this morning, and if you have a question for Nathan, call us 395-1450. All right.
Back to protecting those digital assets.
Yes.
So you've got your Amazon account, you've got your Facebook account, you've got your iTunes account, and you've decided that you are going to use your email, you know, juke@gmail.com as your login, and you're going to use the easy to remember password, you know, juke123 as your password on all of those accounts. Very easy for you to remember, very easy for you to keep track of, nice and short and easy to plug in. Problem is, very easy for somebody else to guess.
That's right.
And so you say, well, I'm not going to use, you know, juke123. I'm going to use the name of my oldest child or the name of my pet as the password, because nobody will be able to figure that out. No, wrong. They will be able to figure that out, especially if you like to post pictures of your cat on Facebook along with the name of your cat with the picture. People can very easily figure out what those passwords are. So how do you get over that? You know, most of us don't have brains that allow us to remember very complicated strings of characters, because any good password is not only going to have letters and is not going to be necessarily a word that anybody would guess, but it's also going to have numbers that are along with it and those special characters, you know, the number symbol and an ampersand and all kinds of different, and maybe the @ symbol in it, to try to make it much more complicated to remember. Luckily, there is software out there now that will not only remember those passwords for you, but it will help you generate passwords. There are any number of them out there, but there's one actually that I use frequently in all of the things that I do. It's called 1Password. It's got the number 1 and then it's password, but there are multiple other ones out there that you can take a look at. And the reason why I really like it and use it the way that I do is it is automatically included in with my computer. So anytime I'm going onto the internet on any of my computers, it's right there. And it synchronizes with my iPhone and my iPad and my office computer and my home computer, so that wherever I am, I can click into that and look up an individual password, or it will automatically figure out which password goes with which website. And I only have to remember 1 master password.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't keep track of all of the different passwords that I have out there. Matter of fact, my son was doing some work on my computer, and he said, "Dad, you have like 300 different passwords out here for all of these different things." And I said, "I do." And some of them are 32-character hexadecimal passwords that there's no way I'd ever be able to remember it, but the software remembers it for me.
Yeah.
So, and it will generate those passwords, so I don't even have to make them up. It will say, "Would you like," every time I go to a website where I'm logging in, it will automatically say to me, "Do you want to, 1, do you want to remember this password? 2, would you like us to create a password for you?" And I usually say, "Yeah, go ahead, do that. 1, remember it. 2, generate a really difficult one." And I know that if I'm going to log into that website later on my phone or on my iPad, that information is already in there in that software. And I am one of very few people that know my master password to be able to get in there. And I change that master password frequently. So rather than having Juke 123, I can have something a little bit more complicated right, that I can remember. Why is that important from an estate planning standpoint? Well, I go to banking websites because I have multiple banks that I can access that information online. I have a Facebook account. Yes, I have a Twitter account. Yes, I have an Amazon account. Yes, I have an iTunes account. And thanks to the fact that I have 3 children, I probably have hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars worth of media on that iTunes account that if I were to pass away and nobody else knew the password to be able to get in there, that information's lost. That data's lost. That asset is lost. And so I actually have a cheat sheet that I put together for my wife, and because she'll often say to me, "If you pass away, I'm in big trouble."
Right.
Because she doesn't know the bank password. She doesn't know the iTunes password to be able to get into those things. And I said, "Honey, all you have to do is remember this 1 password." And I said, "If you do that, here's the cheat sheet for the software. You know that 1 password. You will be able to get access to all of that information after I pass away, and you'll be able to move all of those accounts. You'll be able to access all of my email. You'll be able to get into the encrypted things in my office computer that without that you'd never be able to get into, and that information would be locked away." More and more people are starting to realize that that's something that needs to be done, and mm-hmm. that's something that needs to be dealt with estate planning. And I am frequently dealing with clients now and saying, you need to be thinking about what it is you need to do with those passwords. If you pass away, can somebody else get into your online banking? Can the right people get into your online banking? And so for all of the listeners out there, whether you're somebody like me with 300 different logins out there across the internet, or you're somebody who has just 1 or 2, we still need to be able to deal with that. In administering estates, I've had clients bring in a family member's laptop and say, "I know there's stuff on here, but I can't get past the initial login
right.
screen. How am I supposed to be able to get past that login screen?" And it can be very difficult, and the security on these devices is getting much better.
Mm-hmm.
When I was on vacation on spring break, I didn't have a password code on my phone at the moment. My son looked over at me and said, "Dad, you really ought to, you're on vacation. You're not in the security of your office. You ought to put a password on your phone." I said, "No, you're right." So I quick put a password on my phone. I quick did a confirmation on it. And apparently, I entered that password combination incorrectly twice. And did not remember what it was that I had put on there, and now I am stuck at Disney World of all places with the inability to be able to access my phone, which meant I couldn't access my email, which means I couldn't do text, which means I couldn't do phone calls, and what ended up happening is it gave me the opportunity to try a couple of different combinations.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I'd tried three or four times, it said, well, now we're going to make you wait a minute before you do another one. So I'd wait a minute, and I would try throughout the day. I kept trying to go, well, how might I have screwed this up for myself? And eventually, before noon even on that day, the phone completely shut down. And it said, we are not going to allow you to do anything more with this phone until you connect it up to the computer that you initially synchronized this phone with. Luckily, I had that laptop with me, but that was a system that was designed by the manufacturer to protect me if somebody stole my phone.
Right.
That they wouldn't be able to keep trying combinations as long as they wanted to, that eventually it would shut itself down. Well, if I were to pass away and nobody else knows that combination to be able to get into my phone's going to be shut down.
Useless. Nope.
And it's useless, and all of the information that's on there, and yes, I carry a lot of information around with me on my phone and my iPad, that's all going to be gone. And so folks need to be keeping in mind what it is they need to do with that digital information and how it is that they need to protect it. And lawyers are starting to develop systems to be able to do that and use services to be able to help clients protect that information.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like locking the combination in the safe.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, yeah. It's this digital safe, and you don't want the combination to your lock to be 123 because that's too easy to guess. So you want to keep that information safe.
Mm-hmm.
We are also now storing documents for clients electronically. I joke that I have a paperless office, which means I only have 400 linear feet of files that I'm dealing with right now in actual paper documents. but with new clients, when they come in, we put all the information together. They walk out of the office with a hard copy, but I don't keep a hard copy of the documents. I keep electronic versions stored in 5 separate encrypted locations
mm-hmm.
that I can access because I have the passwords to it from anywhere. And I've talked to some folks before. They say, well, doesn't that make you nervous that you don't have a paper copy? And I said, well, you know, my office could burn down and those paper copies could be gone. Somebody could break into my office probably easier than they can break into the encrypted server that I'm using to store those documents. And I said, what's nice is it provides a whole lot of flexibility for those clients in being able to access those documents. On that same vacation, I was sitting in Florida, and I got an email from a client that said, hey, I'm in Florida, and I need a copy of my will. Can you get me a copy of my will? And I emailed them back, and I said, you know, funny thing, I'm in Florida about 30 miles from where you are, and yes, I can. I have access to that because I had my phone with me, and my phone allows me to access that and email that to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It provides a whole lot of flexibility for folks, but again, need to have the ability to access those documents.
Right. Okay. Let's take a moment out here for a weather word, and the weather is brought to you by the Wooden Shoe Restaurant. Come in for lunch and pick a pair. And the weather today, we're looking at mostly sunny with a high of 84. Clear tonight with a low of 63. And tomorrow, plenty of sun with a high of 88. Sunday, times of sun and clouds with a high of 90. Currently, it's 69 degrees here in the Tulip City. And at the beach, the water is 69. And green flag is flying. So you won't be able to know if you're going in or out of the water. It's kind of nice.
Okay. I was out at the beach at Lake Town early this morning, and it was calm as calm could be. It was actually a very beautiful day. Ran into a guy who was out swimming in the water at 6 o'clock this morning already, training for something because he had a wetsuit on, and I was surprised to see him out there all by himself in the morning. But a beautiful day out at the beach.
Good.
So how do you do this, Juke? How do you get started with this process? Because I'm sure you're thinking, well, I don't have 300 different accounts like Nathan does, but I've got a few of them out there.
I still have a dumb phone. We got a call coming in. I think. Good morning. You're online with the attorney.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm stupid. Boy, what a mess. Anyhow, if you have a house and you're, how long do you have to live in it to get the homestead or?
It just needs to be your primary residence. And to answer your question and to try not to sound too sarcastic, 2-3 seconds is really all the length of time you need to live in it. It just needs to be your primary residence, and you're only allowed to have one primary residence. And you make the designation. Most cases, people make that designation at the time that they purchase the property. You know, if you're purchasing through a typical process where you're dealing with a title insurance company, they'll oftentimes file that paperwork for you. But there are documents available at the treasurer's office. You can even get them online. And the terminology that you would want to use if you wanted to download the form, it's called the PRE, Primary Residence Exemption Form.
I'm stupid. I don't have a computer.
You can go down to the local tax assessor's office and file it there if you'd like to.
Yeah, but how long do you have to live in a house? I moved out because my wife was in a nursing home, and I wanted to be close to her, and I couldn't drive.
Okay.
And I moved out almost 3 years ago.
Okay.
And this house is still there.
Okay.
And they'd taken away my
your primary
homestead.
Yeah, they took away your homestead because you were not actually living in the premises.
Right.
Yep.
Well, if I sell it now and I haven't been there for 3 years, will I have to pay extra?
Oh, we're talking about a different tax on this. You're talking about this has to do with the capital gains tax,
yeah,
rather than the homestead property tax.
Right.
With that, I apologize. I don't know that number right off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
But it's generally, if you move back in, and I'm getting myself out on thin ice with this, so I'm not even going to answer the question. I'd have to look it up for you. But you'll want to make sure, if you've got the ability to move back in, and you're thinking about doing that, that's a very good question to ask. If you want to give my office a call later, I'd be happy to look it up for you and give you the answer to that, because that may make a big difference for you in terms of what it is you're able to do with taxes and not do. But I'm hesitant to give you any kind of definite answer without looking it up.
Well, I thought there was something about 2 or 3 years in the last 5 or something.
Yeah, I think you are on the right track with that. The problem is I don't know right off the top of my head exactly what it is, and I don't want to send you down the wrong path. Yeah. I don't want you to go, well, Nathan told me all I had to do was live there for 2 years and I'd be fine, when in fact it was 3.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Nathan.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
All right, 395-1450, our number here, if you'd like to talk to the attorney this morning.
Yeah,
mine's open.
So you take your dumb phone, Juke.
Yeah.
And actually, what you do, what I tell people to do is you ought to be doing the same kind of thing with your digital assets, with your electronic assets that you're doing with your more traditional assets. You need to do an accounting, do a balance sheet. You know, figure out what it is that you have. And I'm always surprised that I shouldn't be surprised anymore, but I still am, that a lot of people don't even really have a complete handle on what their regular assets are.
Mm-hmm.
That they'll say, you know, I'll be talking to them about that. I'll say, well, I think I've got, you know, this little life insurance policy that I got from the credit union when I signed up for the account. And
Gee,
do we still have that account? What's in that account? You really ought to sit down and make a list of what it is that you have, and then figure out who has control of those and what's going to happen with those if you were to pass away or if something would happen to you. And we do the same thing with the digital assets that we do with the traditional assets in doing that assessment. And then what we can do is we can go down the line with those digital assets and start making the adjustments that we need to make with those, the same way that we do with checking accounts and savings accounts and investment accounts. And for me, because I haven't been doing this for that long, maybe 3-4 years I've been doing the assessment and accumulated those 300 different logins in the software in those 3 years, it's by having the software remind me every time.
Mm-hmm.
You have a dumb phone. I don't want to have to remember anything that I can write down or that something else can remember for me, and software does that. I think we've got a call coming in.
Yeah. Good morning. You're online with the attorney.
Yes, I have a quick question for the attorney.
Sure.
Okay.
Are we on?
Yes, we are.
Yes, I have a question in regards to probate. The situation is this, that the executor, the estate of the mother went to probate upon her death. She was a widow. She was named the executor. There's 4 children.
Who was named the executor?
Who named it?
No, who was the executor? You said that the mother died, but then you said she was named the executor, and I'm guessing...
Mother died and named one of the daughters executor.
Okay, one of the daughters was. All
right. Right, and And so she's in another state. I understand laws are different in each state. But so it's in probate now. There was two pieces of real estate. She sold the one, and there was some savings. She put that away. She has no correspondence with the other three members of her family. Will not tell us anything of what's going on. And the one cottage that's left here in Michigan, she decides she doesn't want to sell. And she won't put it on the market. So she's holding us hostage because probate court will not settle the account until that piece of property is disposed of. And I want to know if there's a statute of limitations, how long can she get away with this?
And, you said the probate's actually taking place in another state?
Yes, sir, California.
Okay, okay. I don't know. I don't know California law well enough to be able to tell you exactly how long that she has.
Right, I figured that, but I just wondered if there is.
There generally is. The courts don't like people to drag their feet. Courts like to have things continue to move forward. If this were in Michigan, you're initially the personal representative, executor. Michigan uses the term personal representative. Personal representative is given 1 year for their initial appointment. And then after a year, you've got to apply to have that extended. The court will generally do that second year, pretty much no questions asked. The next year, another year goes around, the court starts asking for the reasons why. And any one of those beneficiaries, any one of the interested parties, could petition the court in California and say, hey, she's not doing her job. She's not getting this thing done. One of the things that may be holding up the thing in Michigan is you generally need to do what's called an ancillary probate in the second state. So that there may need to be just an abbreviated probate here in Michigan to deal with this Michigan property. Because states are very protective of the real estate that is within their borders. And so the California court does not have the authority to be able to deal with the real estate that's in the state of Michigan. So you need to have a Michigan probate. And essentially, it names the same person, and it says, okay, we're going to give the same authority that she has in the state of California, but we're going to give her the ability to handle this property here in Michigan.
Well, who should we go to first?
Did you receive any paperwork from the California court?
Only one receipt for some of the sale of the contents of the home.
You may want to contact, if there's an attorney that is dealing with the estate in California, you can talk to them.
There is an attorney from probate court who's handling the
okay.
matter.
You may want to contact them and say, hey, we're not satisfied with how this is moving along. You may need to hire your own attorney in the state of California to be